Imagine clocking into your job on a Monday morning. You know, you put your head down, you do the work, you navigate all the usual office politics, and you don't clock out until 38 hours of hard labor have passed.
Right. I mean, it's just your standard exhausting corporate week.
Exactly. But now I want you to imagine that you're 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because according to the front page of the Diario de Comptes on June 5, 2026, that is the exact reality for students in Portugal right now. 38 hours a week at school.
It's just a staggering number to see in print.
It really is. So, okay, let's unpack this because today, for this deep dive, we are looking at a stack of four major Portuguese newspapers from this specific Friday. We've got Público, Diário de Notícias, Correio de Manhã, and Jornal de Notícias.
A really solid cross-section of the daily news.
Yeah, and our mission today is to take these front pages, lay them side by side, and really figure out the friction between the official narratives a country tells about itself and the actual exhausting reality that people are living on the ground.
And when you look across all four of these publications, a very clear systemic theme emerges right away. Yeah, I mean, this isn't just a random collection of daily events. You are looking at a society that is fundamentally squeezed.
Squeezed how exactly?
Well, institutions, government bodies, and just everyday individuals are desperately trying to adapt to these rapidly changing economic and demographic realities. And they're trying to do it using 20th century structures that just can't keep up.
Let's actually stay with that 38-hour school week for a second, because the
Yeah.
experts quoted in that Diario de Notícias article are raising massive red flags.
I'm not surprised.
Right. They're warning about the severe toll this takes on a child's mental health. And I mean, it sounds absurd on its face. Kids don't need a full corporate work week just to learn fractions.
No, they don't. But what's crucial to understand here is the why behind this schedule. The educational system hasn't just suddenly decided that 38 hours of pedagogy is the optimal way to teach a child. This is, it's essentially a quiet structural adaptation to the modern labor market.
Oh, because the parents are working more.
Exactly. As the cost of living skyrockets, parents are forced to work way longer hours, or they're taking on secondary jobs just to keep their heads above water.
So the school just kind of has to absorb that overflow?
Yeah. The school system morphs, by pure necessity, into a state-subsidized childcare facility. The children are physically parked at school because the economic reality dictates that their parents simply cannot be home.
Man. So the squeeze really starts at childhood.
It does.
But if you flip to the complete other end of the generational spectrum, the situation is arguably even more tense.
You're talking about the elder care crisis.
Yes, exactly. Both Público and Correio de Manhã dedicate major space to this breaking crisis in nursing homes. You have President Seguro publicly calling for five urgent measures to rescue these facilities.
Right, because they are really struggling right now.
Yeah, he's sounding the alarm on the crippling monthly costs that families are facing just to keep their parents in these homes. But here is the detail in Público that really caught my eye.
What's that?
The crucial reinforcements for these homes, specifically this psychosocial support that everyone agrees is desperately needed, it won't actually be implemented for 3 years.
3 whole years.
Yeah, because the funding is completely tied up in the PTRR.
Right, the PTRR, the Recovery and Resilience Plan.
Which is European money, right?
Exactly. This is the massive post-COVID funding package from the EU. I mean, it was designed to modernize infrastructure and provide this huge social safety net, but the bureaucratic realities of actually deploying those funds are incredibly complex.
Okay, but I want to challenge you on this whole bureaucratic failure narrative for a second.
Go ahead.
We are talking about fundamentally expanding a national healthcare and social support apparatus, right? We're talking about hiring specialized staff, building out physical facilities, creating entirely new medical protocols. Doesn't that just objectively take time? Like, are we unfairly blaming red tape and bureaucracy for something that is just governed by the basic laws of physical and organizational reality? A 3-year wait seems, I don't know, kind of realistic to build something durable.
I see your point. And if we were just talking about pouring concrete for new hospital wings, your logic would hold up perfectly. Physical infrastructure definitely takes time. But what's fascinating here is that the PTRR funds in question aren't just for bricks and mortar.
They aren't.
No, they're earmarked for immediate psychosocial support teams and operational reinforcements. We're talking about human capital that is needed right now to stop the bleeding in these severely understaffed homes.
Oh, I see. So it's not waiting on construction.
Exactly. The delay isn't about construction at all. It's about compliance. It's about the staggering friction of navigating European Union auditing rules, you know, matching national budgets to international grants, and passing legislative milestones before a single euro can actually be spent on hiring a nurse.
Wow. So the money exists, but the pipeline is just completely clogged.
Exactly. You have a demographic bottleneck colliding directly with an administrative one.
That's a great way to put it.
Because human frailty operates on a timeline of days and weeks. A senior citizen who needs psychosocial care today cannot wait for some municipal committee to sign off on an EU compliance audit in 2029.
Yeah. Their needs don't pause for paperwork.
Right. The demand for care is scaling exponentially with an aging population, but the state's response mechanism can only move at the linear, sluggish speed of a budget calendar.
That makes total sense. And honestly, it perfectly sets up the next major theme I noticed in this stack of papers.
The stats versus reality thing.
Exactly. The massive disconnect between high-level statistics and ground-level survival. Because on this very same day, Diario de Noticias runs a huge feature on Environment Day.
Right.
And on paper, you know, in the official macro statistics, Portugal is a shining star in Europe. The environmental and green energy metrics look absolutely fantastic.
So they made a huge strides there.
They have. But the headline explicitly points out this brutal paradox. Despite these incredible national statistics, the actual citizens are living in cold houses.
Yeah, that is the textbook definition of energy poverty. And it really shows how macroeconomic data can completely mask human suffering.
How so?
Well, Portugal has made massive investments in renewable energy, right? Wind, solar, hydro, all of which produces a pristine report card to hand over to Brussels.
Sure, it looks great on a spreadsheet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But let's look at the actual mechanism of how that energy reaches a home. If the housing stock is old and poorly insulated, which, you know, much of it is, the heat just escapes.
Right.
Furthermore, if inflation on basic goods has totally destroyed a family's disposable income, they simply cannot afford to turn on the heater in the first place, regardless of how green the electricity grid is. The national statistic is a triumph, but the lived reality is freezing.
Wow. And you see that exact same mechanism? Businesses and people just eating the costs of systemic problems happening down in the Algarve, too.
Oh, the tourism piece?
Yeah. Diario de Noticias reports that tourism businesses down south are quietly swallowing the massive spikes in fuel costs and all the economic ripple effects of global conflicts.
Just eating the margins.
Exactly. They aren't passing those costs on to the tourists because they are absolutely terrified of killing the demand. They're just letting their own profit margins vanish to keep the illusion of a stable vacation market alive.
It's all about maintaining the facade.
Right. Meanwhile, Correio de Manhan drops a number that I find absolutely wild. 29,000 complaints against telecom operators in just the first quarter of the year.
That is a huge number. And honestly, it tells a much deeper story than just, you know, bad Wi-Fi connections.
You think so?
Oh, absolutely. 29,000 complaints in 3 months is a glaring symptom of a highly stressed consumer base. In the modern economy, telecommunications are a foundational utility.
Like electricity or water.
Exactly. You need the internet to work, to access banking, to do your child's 38 hours of homework. When household budgets are squeezed so tight that there is zero margin for error, consumers become hypervigilant.
That makes sense. Everything feels like an emergency.
Right. A billing error of 5 euros or an internet outage that costs someone a freelance gig is no longer just a minor annoyance. It is a literal financial threat. The friction you see in those complaints is the sound of an economy stretched to its absolute breaking point.
And the strain isn't just on the families either. It's hitting the local governments themselves.
The municipal payment delays.
Yes. Jornal de Noticias reveals that half of all municipalities in Portugal are delaying their payments to local suppliers. They're averaging a 22-day delay.
Which is creeping up there.
Yeah. Now, the legal limit is 30 days, so they are technically under the wire, but the variance is massive. A city like Setúbal is struggling heavily to pay its bills, while smaller municipalities like Azambuja and Vimioso are somehow managing to pay on time.
It's very uneven.
It really is. It makes me think of a smartphone running on 1% battery with 30 applications open in the background. The screen is still bright. You know, the environmental stats look great. The tourism industry is still taking bookings.
Yeah, the interface looks fine.
Right, but the processor is overheating. The system is lagging. And the basic functions, like a city just paying the local contractor who fixed the sidewalk are starting to freeze up.
I love that analogy.
Yeah.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, what happens when that processor overheats?
The phone crashes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
System starts throwing errors. When citizens are freezing in their homes, when local contractors are waiting weeks to get paid by the city, and when parents are working so much their kids are essentially living at school, that economic exhaustion inevitably mutates into political volatility.
And we see that volatility playing out in real time across three distinct political stories on these front pages. And before I dive into these, I just want to make it super clear to you listening. We are imparting this exactly as it's presented in the sources. We aren't taking any sides here, just looking at the political landscape as these papers have laid it out.
Right, just reporting what's on the page.
Exactly. So first, Diario de Noticias features an interview with Pedro Quinto discussing how Chega, which is the populist hard-right party, maintains a rock-solid fixed electorate of about 20%. Provided they don't alter their core DNA.
Okay, that's one.
Second, over in Publico, the government is trying to pass a highly anticipated labor package, but the vote risks being pushed all the way to 2027. And third, also in Publico, there is this grassroots story about a school in Cascais where parents are in an absolute uproar, actively accusing a geography teacher of hate speech.
None of these events exist in a vacuum, you know.
How do you mean?
Well, the 20% support for a populist party like Chega is a direct mathematical reflection of the people living in those cold houses and waiting on those delayed municipal checks. It is an electorate that feels entirely disconnected from the traditional political center.
They're looking for an alternative because the current system feels broken to them.
Exactly. Then, look at the labor package delay. You have workers who are desperate for updated protections, but the legislative mechanism to help them is physically blocked.
Why is it blocked?
Because the parliament's agenda is completely consumed by the 2027 state budget negotiations. Because the budget takes constitutional precedence, the labor laws just get shoved to the back of the line.
It's that bottleneck again. The government moves in fiscal years, but the worker living paycheck to paycheck moves in days.
Precisely. And that frustration boils over into the cultural sphere, which brings us to the school in Cascais.
The geography teacher situation?
Right. When people feel they have no control over their economic destiny or their legislative protections, they exercise control wherever they can find it.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Yeah. Often that means hyper-local, hyper-reactive cultural battles, like parents going after a geography teacher. The anxiety just has to go somewhere.
So when society gets this reactive, how does the state respond? It tightens its grip.
Oh, definitely.
The front pages show an absolute arms race for physical and technological security. Journal de Noticias covers this massive dawn police operation encircling Porto and Gaia. The PSP checked 1,000 drivers.
A huge operation.
And in the middle of it, they had to shut down a wild 50-kilometer car chase involving thieves in Arquidagua.
That's intense.
Right. And at the exact same time, Publico reports that the public security police are fast-tracking a public tender to roll out 5,200 body cams by December. And then, if we zoom out to the macro, international level, Diario de Noticias notes that Lockheed Martin is aggressively pitching F-35 fighter jets to the Portuguese military, really pushing their performance and lifespan.
You are watching the state scale its response to instability in real time.
It really feels like it.
From a 50-kilometer chase on the ground to thousands of body cams on officers' chests, all the way up to fifth-generation fighter jets in the airspace. The primary tool the state is reaching for to manage all this societal friction is overwhelming technological visibility.
Meaning what, exactly?
The logic is pretty simple. If we can see everything, record everything, and dominate the airspace, we can maintain order.
But here's where it gets really interesting, though, because the concept of visibility is completely falling apart.
You're talking about the AI story.
Yes. While the state is buying up thousands of body cams to guarantee objective truth on the streets, the actual nature of what is true is fracturing. Correo da Manhã runs this bizarre sports story that just perfectly captures this.
It's a crazy story.
It really is. Rui Costa, the president of the Benfica Football Club, was reportedly furious. Why? Because he saw a photograph of the legendary Portuguese coach, José Mourinho, wearing the shirt of rival club Real Madrid.
Which would be a massive betrayal in that world.
Huge. It had the makings of an absolute scandal. Except the coach had to come out and clarify that the event never happened. The high-definition photo was entirely generated by artificial intelligence.
This raises an important question, and honestly, it highlights the central epistemological crisis of 2026. We are witnessing a collision between the hardware of truth and the software of deception.
Wait, I have to stop you there because the contradiction is just too wild.
Go for it.
We are spending public money to strap cameras to police officers because human testimony is no longer considered reliable enough in court. We need the video evidence.
Right.
But at the exact same moment, the technology has advanced so far that the output of a camera, a high-definition image or video, is no longer inherently trustworthy.
It's a paradox.
If a fake photo of a football manager can spark absolute rage in a seasoned club president before anyone even questions the source, what happens when it's a fake audio clip of a bank CEO saying they are out of money?
That is the core vulnerability. Society is outsourcing its trust to technology, just as technology is actively destroying the baseline for objective reality.
It's terrifying, honestly.
And when the digital world becomes a hall of mirrors, people and institutions desperately scramble for alternative anchors of truth. You actually see this elsewhere on the front pages, too.
Where's that?
Journal de Noticias reports that the lawyer for Ricardo Salgado, the disgraced former head of the BES Bank, who has been wrapped up in endless financial scandals, is requesting an international psychiatric evaluation of his client.
Oh, so rather than face the legal reality, they are seeking an external medical authority to establish a truth about his mental state to avoid trial.
Exactly. Whether it's a body cam, an AI detection algorithm, or a panel of international psychiatrists, the entire system is frantically searching for a final authority that can say, this is real.
But, you know, while we debate the philosophical implications of AI and the legal maneuvering of banking titans, the front pages force us to confront a reality that requires no interpretation at all.
The Odivilla story.
Yeah. Because underneath the debates about 2027 budgets and F-35 fighter jets, Correo de Manhan leads with a profoundly devastating story out of Odivelas.
Thoughtful.
A 16-year-old girl was murdered in her own home by her 20-year-old boyfriend, who reportedly could not accept the end of their relationship. The details are horrific. She was beaten with an iron bar and stabbed. The suspect fled the scene, was subsequently hit by a truck, and is currently in a coma.
It is a staggering anchor to the entire conversation we've just had.
It really sobers you up.
It does. When we talk about the squeeze and societal friction, it's very easy to get lost in the academic abstraction of delayed municipal payments and demographic bottlenecks.
Sure.
But this tragedy reminds us that the darkest, most visceral failings of human nature do not wait for the parliament to clear its agenda. They happen in the immediate physical world.
Yeah.
No amount of AI deepfakes changes the permanence of that loss, and no deployment of body cams by December could retroactively protect that teenager in her home. It is a sobering reminder of the limits of institutional power to manage the human condition.
It really puts the bandwidth of the modern citizen into perspective, doesn't it? To wake up on June 5, 2026, and read these papers means processing the tragic physical violence in Odivelas alongside the surreal AI fakes in the sports world, while worrying about your freezing house and your kid's 38-hour week.
It's a massive cognitive load.
It is, which is why I think the newspapers also make sure to include some cultural release valves.
Culture is how a society processes the things legislation cannot fix.
That's beautifully said, and you see it here. Diario de Noticias dedicates space to the global mourning for Marjane Satrapi, the brilliant author of Persepolis.
Such an important voice.
Yeah, and the paper poignantly notes that she reportedly died of sadness. It's a heartbreaking end for a generational voice, providing a real moment of collective reflection.
Yeah.
And then on a lighter, more vibrant note, Journal de Noticias highlights the music scene shifting to the north. Snow Patrol was set to close out the main stage at the Maya Festival that Friday, with The Cure scheduled for Sunday.
That's a great lineup.
Right. It's a reminder that even in a highly pressured environment, the drive to gather, to listen to music, and to experience collective joy remains completely intact.
Those moments of escapism are not trivial, you know? They are functional necessities for a population that is otherwise just sprinting on a treadmill.
Which brings me to a question for you, the listener. When you are confronted with a daily news cycle this dense, where the macro statistics claim everything is fine, but the reality shows exhausted kids, waiting seniors, and a fractured sense of truth, how do you manage it?
It's tough.
How do you stay informed without letting the sheer weight of it all completely drain your capacity to function in your own life?
As you consider that balance, I want to leave you with this final thought to explore.
Let's hear it.
We are watching a society deploy thousands of body cams to record everything and relying on artificial intelligence that can simulate anything. But in our rush to record and simulate the world, Are we losing the capacity to actually pay attention to the real human experiences unfolding right next to us? The 8-year-old exhausted after a 38-hour week, or the senior citizen sitting on a 3-year waiting list. They don't need a high-definition camera to prove their reality. They just need someone to look up from the noise and finally see them.
That is a really profound question to walk away with. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. We hope it helped cut through the noise of the day, and we encourage you to keep looking closely at the reality around you. We'll catch you on the next one.